The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Thursday, January 5th, 2017. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. So I'm doing okay. Yesterday I was, under the weather is a way to say it. I was ill. Now I'm feeling about, I would say about 73%. Not really at 90%, not quite 8%. Yeah, I'm at 73%. Which opens up a lot of questions, doesn't it? Like when people say, I'm about 90%, you could go with it. But when people say, I don't know, I'm about 50%, you always say, well, what is 50%? Well, okay, let's start at this. What's zero? Does zero mean dead? But probably shouldn't mean dead. It should be off the chart, not on the negative side, just somewhere parallel. Like if you're dead, you're not feeling anything. So zero should be a place of unimaginable suffering. So then what's 50? Is 50 like the miserableness of a really bad flu? That doesn't seem like 50. That seems like 30. When a football player says, you know, it's Tuesday and I have until Sunday and right now I'm at 50%, but I'm hoping to get into game shape. I think we understand that that doesn't mean he's experiencing flu-like symptoms and running to the bathroom every 8 minutes. So maybe depending on context, 50% means different things. But even if we could figure out what 50% means and what 90% means, by the way, we do never question 90%. No one ever says, what does 90% mean? But since we don't know what 50% means, I think we got to question what 90% means. But we'd never really give those percentages in between the zeros, maybe with the fives. Same with my oven, right? You got to preheat the oven to 350, maybe 375. Never seen a recipe calling on you to preheat the oven to 329. Just crank it on up to 407. Go nuts. Ovens don't actually even have those numbers. My oven has a big round dial, and it has all the numbers, every 50, and then has a little dot in between the 50s. There's not even much room. I couldn't even tell my oven to go to 407 if I first put it on 400. And are those really the temperatures? Is there anyone who goes inside? I suppose after many years, it will all get out of whack. But when they ship from the factory, are those temperatures that they say really the temperatures inside? I mean, I follow recipes that say cook for 26 to 28 minutes. So they're really specific on that, but then they say 450. What if it turns out that 438 at 27 minutes was the optimal time and minute setting? They'll get specific. They won't say 26 and a half minutes. Though I have seen, you know, recipes that say, especially on the lower end of time, cook for a minute and a half. But they'll never say 361 or 387 degrees. I got one more of these. You're in the gym and you're doing a certain number of sets and reps. Sets can be different, but reps usually end, it's a 10, a 12, or a 15. Sometimes if you're lifting a heavy amount of weight or doing something strenuous, they'll say do 6 or 8. I've never seen anyone advise anyone else to do reps of 7, 11, or 14. No trainer has ever said, all right, you're going to crank out 14 of these overhead presses. So that's what I want to do. I want to be the trainer. I want to be the workout guru. Same exact workout as the other guy, but I'm telling you to do sets of 11. My sets go to 11. With PescaCore CrossFit, you'll be doing sets of 11 because your body is like a high-burning oven set to 491 degrees. And if you do that, you'll be giving your 108%. On the show today, I spiel about Megan with a Y. We've all decided that Megan with a Y is a credible newswoman without a Y. And I ask, why? But first, as I rebounded from a close shave with illness, I bring you a conversation about shaving close. Our guest is Maria Konnikova.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Here on The Gist, specifically the segment, Is That Bullshit? We tackle the great questions of science, great claims, sometimes pseudoscience, sometimes we make the pseudo actual, and other times we do it in the reverse direction. But in the history of Is That Bullshit? I don't know if we've ever taken on as important and as personal a topic as this one. When you shave, does the hair grow back thicker? Is that bullshit? Hello, Maria Konnikova.
Hello, Mike.
As soon as we were exposed to razors, which for me was a dangerously young age, we were told, you know, if you shave it, it'll just grow back thicker. Before we even get to the answers, do we know when people started saying that?
We don't, but I did discover a study from the 1970s that tried to look at it. And in our time together, we've tackled quite the variety of topics, and I've come across some very intriguing studies. Never have I come a study where researchers asked grown men to shave one of their legs, but not the other.
Really?
And then compared the resulting hair to try to figure out whether this actually happened.
I guess that's a good way to do it, a good way to ice. I mean, that's, in fact, I can't think of most A-B testing that is as precise as that. That's really good.
Yeah.
That's controlling for a lot of elements. I mean, maybe people cross their legs in a certain way and rub off hair and bald spots. Maybe people have an unconscious phototropism with their legs. But yeah, I would say that that's a good way to do it.
If in the 70s we already had some men walking around with one shaved and one unshaved leg, I assume that I feel pretty confident saying that at least since the mid-20th century. And I would guess probably since the invention of shaving.
Yeah.
Because as soon as people shave, they're going to potentially notice a difference. We don't know yet if they do, because we haven't answered the assemble.
As I think about it, though, I think it might be better not to do left and right, because there could be differences. We're right-legged, we're left-legged. Maybe people were playing soccer and, you know, leg hair was falling off. Stripes.
Mm.
Alternating stripes and have the patterns differ for both legs. So have an ankle of hair, slightly above the ankle, no hair on the left, and the opposite on the right, all the way up to the thigh area.
It's a shame that you were not around to advise them, because the study would have been much better controlled back then. Now, there were some other issues with the study, such as the fact that they only did this for four people and then drew some
But
eight legs. Yes, exactly. But that was the first evidence of scientists trying to figure out whether shaving actually does anything. Their conclusions were no.
No.
In that particular study.
Yeah.
Once again, four people, eight legs. The methods have since grown more complicated, and dermatologists are actually interested in this because, you know, everyone asks these days for beauty advice.
Yeah.
Everyone, I mean, like I said, I'm guessing that at least the 20th century we've been on this shaving kick of, you know, what actually happens when you shave. And probably even the 19th century, people are vain.
Yes.
People want to know
although
what their hair is going to look like.
Although I've seen a lot of Civil War photos, maybe not as much in the 19th century, but certainly around the time that we were asserting that in olden days, a glimpse of stocking was viewed as something shocking. You know, if the stocking had hair, tufts of hair pulling out of it, that would be quite shocking indeed.
It would indeed. So
who did this study? Who did this study in the 70s? The Nair Institute?
No, it was actually some dermatologists.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is this one of those things where, you know, you joke, but this is really important in terms of surgery? Like a lot of times with pimples.
Well, that's actually a different topic, because people are really wondering, you know, is it correct to shave people before surgeries?
Yeah.
So that's a different area
different
of
area.
Research. Yeah. But that
totally
actually,
different
but
that
actually is, but that actually is another research question.
Okay.
But first, I think we should talk about how hair grows.
Period. Yes.
And as I found out, there are two stages, telogen and anagen.
Mm-hmm.
Telogen means your hair is sleeping. It has grown and it's going to stay that way for a while. And anagen means your hair has woken up and is now going to start growing. It's going to start inching out at whatever rate it inches. Now in the 2010s,
okay.
Right? Is that our decade?
Let's call it that.
The 2010s.
The post-knots.
The post-knots. Now in the post-knots, we actually have some pretty specific measurements about different parts of the body and how rapidly and how long each stage lasts. Now, we're not even talking about shaving yet. We're talking about just naturally how long does your hair last in the anagen stage,
right,
and then how long does it sleep in the telogen stage?
Because I think leg hair, for instance, it seems that if it goes unattended, it won't just grow forever. But facial hair, you know, big bushy beards get bushier over time. And even the guys with the bushiest beards, if they don't shave it, it'll be bushier next year.
That's very true. But if you'll notice, it's usually, I mean, I'm guessing that maybe for some people this isn't the case, but usually everyone has their sort of natural stage at which the hair falls out. Right, because
all
hair does,
hair?
Yeah, all hair,
yes,
and
yes.
Facial hair.
Okay.
All hair falls out eventually.
But what about these guys with the huge beards?
Well, maybe they can grow a lot of it before it falls out.
Okay, yeah.
Just like some people who have very thick hair, they can grow very long hair, you know, down to their legs. And for other people, no matter how many years they don't cut their hair is just never going to grow to that length.
That's me. So there's 19.
There's individual difference when it comes to hair growth. So how do you actually test this?
Yeah.
Now that we have very fine instruments and you can actually look at, you know, what happens to hairs and you can manage kind of rates of growth and all of these different things. I mean, it's crazy what these people do. It's careers devoted to figuring out what happens.
Thank God the science has caught up to our curiosity.
Yes, yes. The short answer is that the hair does not grow faster and does not become thicker. However, it looks like it does. So natural hair has a naturally tapered end. What happens when we shave it is we're not actually getting rid of the entire hair. We're not yanking it out.
Right.
Right. We're keeping that hair, except we're taking off that tapered end and the rest of it. And so then when it grows, what we start seeing is the blunted edge rather than the tapered end. So it's not actually any thicker.
Yeah.
It just looks thicker and it looks darker.
But since most people who are considering this or who are told don't shave, it'll grow back thicker, like about your eyebrows, since all they care about is not the actual but the appearance, the answer might as well be yes.
Yes, it will appear thicker.
Yes.
But what happens in terms of the duration and the intensity of growth, those things remain unchanged. So one of the misperceptions, I don't know what dermatologists think the general public is reading, but according to them, this misperception that hairs grow faster came from studies of neonatal mice.
Oh,
because
yeah.
We're all reading studies of neonatal mice. So when you look at studies of neonatal mice, when you shave, it triggers a switch from telogen to anagen.
How do you get the little razor in there, in the mouse uterus?
I did not read this particular paper. So.
But neonatal means in the womb, yes?
Yes. So they can actually do...
Or does it mean newly born?
It can mean either.
Okay.
So
that's a pretty bad word then.
Well, so a neonatal unit is a unit in the hospital that tracks mothers who are either expecting babies that are expecting to have problems or premature babies. So my sister actually happens to be a neonatologist.
Really?
So
Of mice?
No, of humans.
People. Okay.
And so they... So mostly it's newborns who are born, but you can also do something called neonatal surgery, which means you actually open up the uterus and do some surgery and then...
So when we talk about the neonatal mice, though, it's usually mice that have just been born.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And people have been shaving them.
People have been shaving them.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
And what they find?
So what they find is that when you shave them... I can't keep a straight face.
Yeah.
When you shave these neonatal mice, it ends up triggering anagen that might make people think that the hair is suddenly growing faster because the hairs were asleep and then they suddenly wake up. So
this is the version
of
slapping
phase.
The baby, shaving the mouse.
Exactly.
You don't want to shave the mouse.
So you slap it and then the hair starts growing.
Right.
Whereas before it was sleeping.
Interesting.
But it doesn't actually change the duration of the hair growth. It mm-hmm. will then, it just kind of resets the phase, and then the hair will stop growing as soon as it naturally stops growing. But you know what we actually have found out as well, which I think might be where the misperception actually comes from rather than neonatal mice. When do you shave more, in the winter or the summer?
I guess the summer, right?
That's what I would
guess.
Yeah,
yeah.
And it ends up that there's a seasonality to the rate of our hair growth.
Ah.
So hair, we're like crops. We're like wheat. Hair actually grows faster in the spring and summer and grows slower. It's at its slowest stage in the fall and winter.
These just are the, when you need it. Just
exactly.
when you need the big bushy beard.
So Mike, these are the things I find out for is this bullshit?
Yeah. This is your payment. We pay you in knowledge. And also anagen. And what are the two words?
Intelligen.
Anagen, intelligent. I think it probably came from not a misperception of the study of neonatal mice. I think it probably came from someone shaved the part where their eyebrows met, and then it looked thicker to them. And they said, it looks thicker.
Yes.
And it was thicker, because if it looks thicker, it is. Well, you're right. If it looks thicker, that's the important thing. But the other part of the don't shave it, pluck it out, that might have some credence to it. Because if you do pluck it out, are you getting it at its roots?
So if you actually get the entire hair, then that is fine, because mm-hmm. you will have a fresh hair that's growing naturally without that blunted end.
Ah, so plucked hair. Now this is all making sense. So plucked hair looks less thick because it doesn't have the blunted end.
Yes, if you pluck correctly. Some people don't pluck correctly.
Yes.
Now I'm sounding like a beautician, but if you actually have to get the
Frank
root, yeah, you have to get it all out.
Yeah,
and if you do, then you're golden.
Yeah, it's plucking hard. It really is. It's a plucking hassle.
Mm.
That's what I find. Mm. All right, but now we could render our verdict, and the question is: when you shave your hair, or someone, or a loved one's, or a loved mouse, when you shave your hair, it comes back thicker, lusher, faster. Is that bullshit?
That is bullshit.
But I think we need to do the
But if you shave it, it might appear to be thicker because you are looking at the blunted end rather than the natural tapered
from
end.
An aesthetic standpoint, it's not just perception. There is, well, it is perception, but there's reality to the perception.
Yes.
I love
yes.
this. This was, I think, a very successful segment.
I agree. I mean, who knew that we grew like crops, that we have crop rotation going on our heads?
It was plucking fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maria Konnikova, author of The Confidence Game, is both astute and not particularly hirsute. Thank you, Maria.
Thank you, Mike.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where it got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way, or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters, and hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. Every election has winners and losers. Losers of this last one, the Princeton Election Consortium, the Blue Wall, some 400-pound guy on a bed. Winners, Breitbart, Dilbert, but most of all, Megyn Kelly. the most sought-after woman in news has jumped to NBC, and payons to her beauty, her acumen, her poise and charisma have been pouring forth. Now, judged against the tail end of happy hour crowd at the VFW Hall demo that holds down much of the Fox News primetime programming, yeah, Megyn Kelly is a veritable Valkyrie of virtue. Kelly is a good questioner, and she often surprisingly veers away from the Fox News talking points. Often, but not always, and not in the area that Fox News has so sinisterly become adept at stoking, race relations.
Let me get Mark to weigh in on the point about how we've gone to the race place on this.
That Mark being asked to weigh in is Mark Furman. You remember Mark Furman.
Mark Furman is a Fox News contributor and a former LAPD homicide detective.
Furman, during this summer of policing discontent, was Kelly's go-to guest. He, like her, is sure-spoken, steely-eyed, and has a Teutonic forcefulness on television. He was on the Kelly file a half dozen times this summer alone, and she relied on the man who lost the OJ trial for real insight and wisdom.
Mark, need a quick answer on this, but do you think that there were the cops have been demeaned by members of the public?
No better person to ask about the intersection between policing and being demeaning than Mark Furman. Now, look, if I had a chance to interview Mark Furman, I'd take it. I wouldn't keep having him back on again and again and pushing him out there as an unblemished source of wisdom and insight. And I definitely would challenge him on some basic precepts of his argument. Now, his argument has been, this is what he says on the Kelly file, and this is an argument she puts out there all the time, is that police right now are being handcuffed by activists and do-gooders. Here was Kelly on Tuesday night talking about the appalling increase in murder in Chicago.
Well, the former top cop in Chicago says he knows what's going on in his city. And in what he calls a disturbing case of irony, he says the deaths we're seeing are the byproduct of a group that claims to be trying to stop the violence, Black Lives Matter.
Kelly has quoted those who blame the Black Lives Matter. She herself blames elements in the Black Lives Matter movement. She says they've created an anti-cop atmosphere, and she almost never has a policing segment without one of her two guests, often a Black guest, often Mark Furman, to criticize the Black Lives Matter movement. And when they do this, they define the movement as they want to define it, which is to say that they say the Black Lives Matter movement has a message that cops are out to kill African Americans. Two nights ago, Kelly had an entire discussion about the Chicago murder increase, where her premise was how much Black Lives Matter is to blame. Though she did have guests from both sides of the issue, she never brought up this other city besides Chicago where murder has fallen, as have arrest rates and stop and frisk. This city is a city she calls home, where she hosts her TV show out of. It is basically impossible for a Fox viewer to learn or consider this fact, that the entire set of circumstances that they say is dooming Chicago is also in place in a much bigger city, New York, and that set of circumstances, less oppressive policing, has led to a decrease in murder. Fox never considers this. Kelly never brings this up, and neither do her guests. The dominant message is that murder is up, and nationally it is up a little bit, and that it's the crackdown on policing, which they call the Ferguson effect, that explains this. As Megyn Kelly comes to NBC, I'll be interested to note if she brings this blinkered point of view with her, along with her unflappable demeanor and cobalt eyes. Kelly has gifts, and perhaps she needs to be judged on the Fox curve, which is to say that for Fox, she and Shepard Smith occasionally demonstrate some critical thinking and the ability to ask good questions. But she often doesn't. Last night's guests included Omarosa Manigault, actually Teresa Manigault, Omarosa is middle name, nickname, was named as Director of Communications for the Office of Public Liaison in the White House. So this was Manigault's first interview since being named to the post. And here is how Kelly questioned the recidivist reality show contestant about a statement she made to PBS.
You've been so fun to watch on The Apprentice. You were always a crowd favorite, including my own. Mm-hmm. But you made controversy earlier this year on this PBS Frontline documentary when you said that, well, I'll just play the soundbite. Here it is.
Uh-oh. Every critic, every detractor will have to bow down to President Trump. It's everyone who's ever doubted Donald, whoever disagreed, whoever challenged him. It is the ultimate revenge to become the most powerful man in the universe.
Now,
wow, it sounds so ominous.
It does with the music
and the lighting. I taped that.
Yeah, do you want to explain
probably
that?
Probably 4 or 5 months before, you know, I joined the campaign.
And then Manigault, I do like being the only person who calls her by her surname, basically said that Trump's election represents a time of reckoning among the formerly dubious. Though we did hear Manigault saying that that PBS interview was done months before she joined the Trump campaign. Therefore, I guess her argument is, had I known that it mattered and I was being accountable, I would have tempered my true thoughts, something like that. But in fact, her assertion, it was done months before. This is what many of us in news might at one time have called a lie. That interview happened on June 23rd, 2016, and Donald Trump appointed Manigault his director of African American outreach the first day of the Republican National Convention, which is to say July 18th, 25 days, not months after the interview happened. Additionally, for the 6 months prior to officially being named director of African American outreach, Manigault served as a board member for the National Diversity Coalition for Trump. She did interviews for Trump. She was quoted as a Trump surrogate and was generally known to be on the Trump team. It's one of the reasons why she was interviewed. Kelly either didn't note it, didn't care, but she let it go. It was just one moment, but one of Kelly's jobs at NBC is said to be interviews with newsmakers and personalities. She was clearly treating Omarosa as a personality, even though she has a job in the White House, but she didn't do a good enough job interviewing this personality. She didn't reveal anything or get anywhere. This past year with Fox, Kelly did a primetime Barbara Walters-esque special, and it generally fizzled. There was a Trump interview that was more gauzy than gritty, and there were a couple of duds of interviews with the likes of Laverne Cox, Robert Shapiro, Michael Douglas. There's a special alchemy to these kinds of interviews, and I'm not the intended audience for them. But as for the hard news, I can see why Megyn Kelly has a sheen about her. I'm just not sure her star will translate when judged against the more conventional stable of pre-post-truth journalism embraced by NBC. And that's it for today's show. Chris Berube and Mary Wilson are on cloud 7.5, maybe 8 1/3. When Steve Lickteig, executive producer of Slate Podcasts, was a young man, he'd go to confession and the priest would assign him 4 Hail Marys and a baker's dozen Our Fathers. Andy Bowers, chief content officer of the Panoply Network, spent some time in the second city, Chicago, St. Louis, the 29th city, Ashburn, North Carolina, the 181st city. The Gist, we support a national highway built capped the speed limit at 63, 61 in a school zone. Umperu de Peru du Peru, and thanks for listening.